Facts, but no truth. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A filmmaker makes a documentary about Russian meddling in the U.S. elections, but with a twist.
We decided to make a movie out of factual television and the news without a single true statement in it. You know, we thought that if you could do this, it would be kind of a significant statement about the informational ecosphere that we're living in.
Plus, in Yemen, a young woman and her family plan a wedding as Saudi planes drop bombs.
All of a sudden, my mom sees the planes and she freaks out because the first airstrike hit, and it was very close.
And an English pub owner watches as rising seas threaten his business.
We're just an old-fashioned inn right on the coast. Sadly, with a very short life left.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. So there's WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, Skype. There are all sorts of messaging apps out there. There's another called Telegram. You might not have heard of it unless you use it to be in touch with someone in a country where it's popular. One of those places is Iran. You might remember hearing on the show that the Iranian government blocked the service during protests there late last year. And now a similar story is playing out in Russia. Today, the Russian government took its most aggressive step yet to totally ban Telegram in the country. The World's Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. This legal fight between the Russian government and Telegram, Charles, it's been going on for a while now. So bring us up to speed. Why is the Russian government going to block it, and now?
Well, they're moving to block Telegram under the argument that these encrypted messaging services like Telegram are tools for terrorists. You know, there was a big international security conference here in Moscow this week where the head of the FSB, that's the successor agency to the KGB, a guy by the name of Alexander Bortnikov, he got up and argued that these services allow terrorists to communicate and plan attacks in the shadows. And as you note, just today, the internet governing body here in Moscow formally filed suit in court to block the service. This is just the latest step. There's a legal battle ahead.
And how has Telegram responded to all of this?
Well, you know, the company has refused to hand over the keys. The owner of the company is a guy by the name of Pavel Durov. He's a Russian. He's said always that in contrast to these other tech companies, Telegram, quote, has your back. And, you know, you might say, Marco, okay, all these tech guys kind of say that same thing.
Right.
But Durov has this story that backs it up in a way. Because before Telegram, he launched ВКонтакте, or VK as it's sometimes known. This is back in 2006.
And that was kind of like the Russian version of Facebook, right?
That's right, yeah. So he has even this nickname, at least certainly in the West, called the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia. Mm. You know, the company was wildly successful, or it was until Russian authorities came after Durov demanding that he hand over user data. He refused, but it wasn't an easy process. He eventually had to give up the company. He was forced to sell off his shares. And VK, or ВКонтакте, ended up in Kremlin-friendly hands, hands that, in fact, do give over user data to the authorities.
So what happened to Durov after that?
Well, you know, Durov, he walked away from it all. He went into self-exile from Russia. He actually bought citizenship on a remote island. But he remains this, you know, kind of figure of fascination to younger Russians in particular, not only because of his tech history, but also of his lifestyle. He doesn't give a lot of interviews. He's vegetarian. He advocates clean living, so he doesn't drink or smoke. You know, so he's kind of this sort of Russia philosopher monk of tech.
I'd like us to hear some more clues about what motivates Durov. This is from a Q&A he did back in 2015.
Privacy, ultimately, and our right for privacy, is more important than our fear of bad things happening, like terrorism.
Charles, what about the Kremlin's charge that Telegram has enabled terrorist attacks, or is that just part of a broader strategy by the Russian government to tighten its grip on any online communications?
Well, it's probably both. I mean, yes, of course, Russia faces problems with terrorism. They've had attacks several times over the past several years. And you could argue that Telegram is one instrument that allows all these, you know, nefarious actors to plan such attacks. But, you know, a lot of people will say this has little to do about fighting terrorism. It's more about political repression. They'll point to a raft of these restrictive internet laws that were passed over the past 5 years in Russia. And many of these put onerous requirements on the tech companies to provide user data to the authorities when they require it. And let me bring in another voice here. This is Andrei Soldatov. Soldatov is a leading Russian investigative journalist on internet security issues. And he says that these laws have little to do with fighting terrorism and everything to do with control.
problem is that the Russian security services, they have a very totalitarian idea of security. And they cannot tolerate that somewhere on the Russian soil, there could be a telecommunication service which could not be intercepted.
You know, as I think about this wall between tech and government, my mind goes back to the dispute between the FBI and Apple after the 2015 San Bernardino shooting. The phone was left behind, and the FBI wanted to bypass a security code to get into the shooter's iPhone. Apple said no, they wouldn't help. And Durov actually spoke about that case with the BBC 2 years ago, saying he sided with Apple's CEO at the time.
Tim Cook argues that there's no way he can unlock that specific phone without increasing the chance that hundreds of millions of users of iPhone will have this increased risk for their privacy.
So, Charles, I know I'm asking you to generalize here, but how do you think the average Russian sees this debate about striking the right balance between privacy and security?
Well, you know, I think the people who actually pay attention to these issues, you know, after Snowden's revelations, there's a sense that this issue is just kind of settled, you know, that they want end-to-end encryption, and not just from the Russian government, but from any government, from the U.S. government as well. So, of course, there are always going to be these people, like in the U.S., there are Russians who say, well, you know, if it helps national security or stops a terrorist attack, why not? I have nothing to hide. But the problem is that judging by past actions here in Russia, the state tends also to monitor dissidents or opposition figures, or just use these laws to send warnings to the general public. So we've seen, you know, dozens of cases over the past several years where people are sentenced under this extremism law and given real prison time, like real prison time for sharing a post or liking something on social media.
Finally, Charles, there was also some news this week about the other company Durov founded, VKontakte. You mentioned that earlier. And that had to do with a credit history bureau now being able to mine users' profiles. Explain that.
Well, yeah, that's right. So Mail.ru Group, this is the owner of Kontakte, they will allow this National Bureau of Credit History to analyze borrowers' public profiles. You know, it's a concession to the Russian banks trying to collect. It's not quite Cambridge Analytica creepy, but in terms of hard, you know, but it's still pretty creepy,
yeah,
all the
close.
Same. Yeah, it's close. It's also really not surprising. I think that, you know, again, Kontakte's track record, again, under new ownership post Durov, after Pavel Durov left the company, you know, on privacy, it's been pretty terrible. I mean, even just this week, we saw an activist in Siberia sentenced to a year and a half in jail. And she was just hosting a photo on her Kontakte account that was set, in fact, to private. So it wasn't even shared with anyone. It was then this activist, Oksana Poldakhun, you know, she's serving time. And, you know, the sense is that she's not the first and probably not the last.
Extraordinary. The world's Charles Maine speaking with us from Moscow. Always good to talk, Charles. Thank you for this.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's hear now from Russian President Vladimir Putin. This is from a documentary called Our New President.
Доставлять альтернативную информацию для зрителей и слушателей. Представляю, насколько это сложно работать в таком постоянном режиме, постоянно печь эти информационные блины у печки.
Информационные блины. Did you hear that? Informational pancakes. That's what Putin called the alternative news that Russian TV anchors cooked up for viewers. And Putin thanked the anchors for those pancakes. Our new president is directed by Maxim Pozdorovkin, who's based in New York. He was also behind the 2013 documentary about Pussy Riot. But our new president is not like any movie you've ever seen before. So, Maxim, where'd you get this idea to make a non-narrated film edited entirely out of archived Russian newsreels and YouTube videos?
Our editor came back to New York from visiting his mom in Russia, and he was like, everyone's very excited about Trump. Everyone keeps calling him our new president, our new president. So we decided to make a movie out of factual television and the news without a single true statement in it. We thought that if you could do this, or even if you could approach doing this, it would be kind of a significant statement about the informational ecosphere that we're living in.
Well, you kind of do a great job of duplicating that propaganda in the beginning of the film with these kind of constant clips of Hillary Clinton on Russian TV. And I got to say, the level of loathing of her in Russian media was something that I wasn't really ready for. And a lot of it was like tabloid gossip turned into journalism, not to mention really unflattering pictures and clips of her. How many Russians took all of that at face value?
even if they do believe it or if they don't believe it, they don't have a clear grasp of reality. And most of these people have no firsthand experience of America outside of a television. So it's the idea is that they have this kind of inconsistent, wild picture, which we distill even more in the film. And but they're making their decisions and they're making their kind of, you know, political viewpoints. They're regurgitating them on the internet and they're regurgitating a lot of this stuff. Whether they believe it or not is almost secondary to the fact that the information gets out there and it travels, or the disinformation, rather.
Maxime, I gather you were born in Moscow. What is your own personal relationship to Russian state media?
For years, I've made films about Russia, and also a lot of my family still lives in Russia. So I would have these arguments with my father and lots of other members of my family about these television channels, about this kind of coverage, about the level of fabrication that exists there. So it was kind of a personal battle. And I'm not sure that I've won it, but I think a lot of people that see the film, and especially Russian people that are aware of how corrosive these federal channels have been for the Russian population, kind of come up and they're very appreciative of it.
Has your family back in Russia seen the film?
Yeah, most of them have seen it. And then, you know.
And do they understand it? I mean, do they understand what the point you're making, or do they believe Russian state media?
This film is, because it's so kind of unfiltered and really tries to just assault you with this material, I don't exactly know how it plays. Let's say for a person who genuinely believes that Hillary Clinton began every day at the White House with a line of cocaine, if a person kind
which
of
is one of the allegations that one of these channels makes, it's pretty extraordinary.
Когда Хиллари Клинтон попала в Белый дом, она привела с собой множество людей, которые употребляли кокаин.
If you actually believe that, or at least think that that's plausible, I'm not sure how this movie plays, because the movie is specifically, you know, putting it all out there, and every single kind of falsification about Hillary, about Trump, even things like introducing Trump as a troubled teenager from Brooklyn, you know, when he's a spoiled brat from Queens.
What do you know about American reaction to your documentary on new president?
The American reaction has been varied. I mean, people tend to be horrified and really sort of shocked by it. They don't know what to make of it. And I think that it is such a let me see. I'm trying to find an alternative for a not-so-nice word here. and then, you know, the film is a combination of the horrifying and the hilarious. And part of the reason of building the film like that is that I didn't want the audiences to have a moral perch where they can sit and look down and say, this is wrong, this is wrong. I wanted them to be implicated. So if you're laughing one second and then you see hear something horrifying the next, you're sort of guilty by association as a kind of consumer of it.
Maxime Pozdorovkin is the director of the satirical but very real documentary, Our New President. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our New President won a special jury award at Sundance. It's not been picked up yet for U.S. distribution, but Maxime says he's hoping for a late summer release. Here's one of my very early lessons in French.
Paris, New York, New York, Paris.
Paris, New York, New York, Paris. That's easy.
Comme un pauvre con tout seul à Orly.
Like a poor jerk all alone at Orly Airport.
J'attends ma petite Suzy qui arrive par le Boeing de 15h33. Tout droit du Minnesota.
I'm waiting for my little Suzy who arrives on a Boeing at 3:33. Straight from Minnesota. French lessons from a man with the voice of Tom Waits and the stature in France of Jacques Brel. That singer was Jacques Higelin, who died today. In France, he's simply Higelin, and his passing has put the French news cycle on hold. Such was his importance to a generation of people there. Here's an appropriately reflective and jaded song Higelin wrote some years ago. It translates, I am dead, who can beat that?
Je suis mort, qui dit mieux? Bah mon pauvre vieux, voilà autre chose. Je suis mort, qui dit mieux? Mort le venin, coupé la rose. J'ai perdu mon âme au chemin. Qui la retrouve, cela m'est aux choses. J'ai perdu mon âme en chemin. Qui la retrouve, la jette au chien.
Jacques Higelin, he died today at the age of 77. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. 2,000 to 4,000 troops on the U.S.-Mexico border. And that's what President Trump said this week he wants to send until Congress approves his demand for a wall on the border. And as you might have guessed, officials on the other side of the border in Mexico are not happy. Jorge Valencia is a reporter with public radio station KJZZ in Phoenix, and he's with us now from the station's Mexico City Bureau. The Mexican Senate unanimously approved a measure yesterday in reaction to President Trump's decision to send troops to the border, Jorge. What does it do exactly?
At least for now, it's a symbolic measure. And in short, what it's saying is that if President Donald Trump doesn't treat Mexico and Mexicans with more respect, then we are going to stop collaborating with the U.S. And that's on issues like immigration or, let's say, fighting drug trafficking. So it's symbolic, but it could have big consequences.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So what exactly is it that these politicians in Mexico are upset about?
A lot. You have to take into account that President Trump started out his campaign by saying that Mexicans brought rape and brought crime into the U.S. And then when he said he was going to send troops to the border, that was not very well received. I sat down with Senator Laura Rojas. She authored this measure. So here's what she had to say.
Another thing that we think that he must do is to stop conducting the relation with the Mexican government based on lies. For example, he has said many times that the only country that has had benefits of our bilateral relation is Mexico, which is not true at all.
The Mexico Institute, which is a think tank based in Washington, did an analysis and they found that 5 million jobs in the U.S. depend on trade with Mexico. And also, by the way, Mexico imports more from the U.S. than much larger economies like China do.
So the current president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, I mean, he's also been dealing with everything from insults to proposed policy changes like ending NAFTA. And he's been pretty diplomatic throughout, it's got to be said. How did he react to this latest business?
So President Peña Nieto has been trying to play the long game, but this time around, it seems like he couldn't stay quiet. And so he gave a televised speech yesterday in which he actually quoted President John F. Kennedy. There was a speech that Kennedy gave in 1961 saying, "Never negotiate out of fear and never fear to negotiate."
No tendremos miedo a negociar, pero nunca vamos a negociar con miedo.
So you can kind of tell from his tone, he's a little stern. It seems like he doesn't want to turn the other cheek this time around. And it's actually really interesting because it's the first official week of the presidential campaigns. And it's perhaps the only issue that the four candidates really agree on. Even the candidates who have strongly opposed the current governing party are giving President Peña Nieto credit for trying to stand up for the country.
Jorge, what is at stake here? Like, what do Mexican politicians want from Trump ultimately?
In short, they want more respect. They want President Trump to, in the words of one politician I spoke with, to stop blackmailing Mexico with things like NAFTA or even DACA, which is really internal U.S. policy. I wanted to get some context on this, so I spoke with Ambassador Tony Garza. He served for 8 years under President George W. Bush, and he takes a little bit of a calm approach to this.
You have to recognize that the biggest threats to both Mexico and the United States tend to be very similar, whether it's terrorism, human trafficking and smuggling, drugs. And the only way that we can effectively deal with transnational threats is through transnational cooperation.
So there are a lot of shared issues, but just what exactly is going to happen from here forward is about as predictable as President Trump is.
Jorge Valencia, reporter at the Mexico City Bureau of Public Radio Station KJZZ. Thanks for your time, Jorge.
Thanks, Marco.
President Trump has a lot to say about migrants crossing the border from Mexico into the U.S., not all of it that well informed. Our next story is about someone who is well informed about that because he's been one of them, but now he says he's done with the U.S. Here's the world's Monica Campbell.
Daniel Vega was just 11 when he left Guatemala. He says his parents died in a car wreck near their home in the mountains. He stayed with relatives for a time, but there was a civil war then. People left. So did Daniel. He's 39 now, stocky with short black hair, and he's worked throughout Mexico.
Aquí en México, estoy en Mexicali, Tijuana, Reynosa, Laredo, San Luis.
And he knows the U.S.
Texas, California, Arizona, Miami, Nueva York, Nevada.
He's worked as an electrician, dishwasher, carpenter, painter, plumber, a barber. He was a cook in San Francisco for 2 years. We met 2 years ago in Mexico at a migrant shelter in Ciudad Juarez across from El Paso. Daniel had just been deported again. He said it was the last time.
Yo dije, ya es mi hora, es mi tiempo.
My time was up in the U.S., he said. He decided to stay in Mexico, undocumented. And last year, when we saw each other again, he'd met someone, Maria Elena Figueroa.
Esta parte.
She showed me her house outside Mexico City. It's one room, really, crumbling cinder block, pretty rough. Water was scarce. They showed me how they have to pump it from a well. María Elena met Daniel on a bus.
Sentí una impresión de gusto.
I fell for him because he was kind, she said. I admired his spirit to go where there's opportunity. That day, they were packing to head to Juarez again. Daniel had heard about a carpenter job.
Pues yo como trabajo en carpintería, yo gano 1,200. Si no pago transporte,
I'll earn about $75 a week, he says. It's better pay there.
La verdad que este camino es difícil, pesado, hambre, sueños, lástimas, herido.
This life, always looking for work, isn't easy, he says. There's hunger, exhaustion. I've seen awful things, migrants falling off trains, but you keep going. This week, I called Daniel to catch up. Daniel.
¿Cómo está?
He was back near Mexico City again after work dried up in Juarez. We talked about the news, about the group of Central Americans moving through Mexico. Many of them say they'll stay in Mexico, like Daniel. What's his advice? Try your best, he says. There are opportunities in Mexico. But also remember, it's not easy being undocumented anywhere. He's changed his accent to sound Mexican, but without papers, he hits walls. He says he was working as a security guard in Mexico at this new housing complex down his street. I remember seeing it, its big gold-colored gates, manicured lawns. But Daniel said that they underpaid him, and because he's undocumented, he didn't fight it. Still, he says he looks over his shoulder less in Mexico than in the U.S. He'd also heard about President Trump's plan to send the National Guard to the border.
No, ahora sí la gente nada lo va a poder detener porque cuando uno quiere algo, hace lo posible por lograrlo.
No, that won't stop people, he says. If people want in, they'll find a way. But as for Daniel, he says he's more committed than ever to staying in Mexico. He has a family there now and wants to put down roots at last. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
I'm Marco Werman. A young couple plans to get married in Yemen, and then the country's political crisis explodes.
The street wars broke out, and the first bomb fell from a Saudi jet.
Getting married in the middle of a war. That's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You've heard us talk about the war in Yemen. We use phrases like worst humanitarian crisis on earth.
And the war just entered its fourth year, Marco.
The World's Stephen Snyder follows Yemen for us at The World.
And we're talking about it this time with the help of a young couple who live just north of the Bronx. I drove down from Boston to see them at the end of February.
My name is Muntasir Yagnam. I was born in Yemen.
Muntasir Yagnam is wearing jeans, a sweater, and a leather jacket. He has short hair, trimmed beard. He drives for Uber. He studied English literature in Yemen. He was a teacher there and a human rights activist calling for political change back in 2011.
So the Arab Spring, the Arab uprising.
That's right. And around then, Muntasir got into this online conversation with a woman in the U.S. with roots in Yemen. Her name is Summer Nasser.
Okay, so I was born in Bronx, New York. I've been raised here in the United States, and right now I'm a full-time student.
Sora Nasser is 23. She wears a traditional headscarf. Her face is composed when she speaks, but it lights up when she laughs.
She was in New York City, and we were, like, chatting in Facebook, and I was posting pictures of the projects and all that.
He was actively following my publications, right. Yes. He enjoyed it. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah.
So she was blogging a lot about Yemen and being Yemeni in America. They decided to meet in Yemen since Summer travels there a lot to see her family, and then they got engaged.
This is a love story.
March 26, 2015, their wedding ceremony is just a few days away in Aden, which is a port city in Yemen, and
the street wars broke out, and the first bomb fell from a Saudi jet that night, and it was just me and my mom and my siblings.
And Muntazir, her soon-to-be husband, he was 200 miles away, texting, calling frantically.
Wow. I mean, people like shooting and bombardment and everything. I mean, I was so worried about her and her family.
So this is not just a love story, it's also a war story.
Saudi Arabia says its airstrikes against Shia Houthi rebels who seized power in Yemen will continue until their military capabilities are severely hampered.
Just a little background on the war and a few names. There's a militant group from northern Yemen called the Houthis. They're named after their leader. About 3 years ago, the Houthis banded together with soldiers who are loyal to the former dictator, Ali Abdullah Saleh.
Who ruled for like a quarter century or so.
That's right. They get together, they take over northern Yemen, including the capital where Muntazir Yaghnam lives.
Muntazir the groom.
And this huge Houthi army marches south to the very bottom of the country, where Summer is staying with her relatives.
Right, so this is the very beginning of the war in Yemen.
Well, clashes like this were not new, but this was a sharp escalation. And then neighbor countries got in the fight, sending air forces in to bomb Houthi positions. It's 10 Arab countries in all, led by U.S. allies Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
So it's the Houthi rebels with Yemeni soldiers on one side against other Yemenis backed by the Saudi-led coalition.
And the Saudi-led war could not happen without U.S. and U.K. arms supplies as well as logistical help.
Samuel Perlow Freeman manages the Global Arms and Corruption Program at the World Peace Foundation just outside Boston. He says the U.S. connection to the Yemen war is clear.
The U.S. is actually helping the Saudis with their logistics, with their targeting. And in choosing to continue to supply arms to Saudi, the UAE, Egypt, and the other coalition partners, they are choosing to continue fueling this war.
The U.S. connection is deep, and we'll explain how deep.
Okay, so thanks for that background, but let's get back to Muntazir and Summer.
It's 2015. Muntazir is in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Summer is in Aden, the southern city where the major fighting is, and where their wedding is supposed to be. And you actually spoke with Summer back then, remember?
And how safe are you all feeling right now with these Saudi airstrikes?
We're not feeling so great. you know, coming from the States to this kind of situation, and to be honest with you, I never thought I would say this, but we really don't know if we would wake up the next morning. I mean, that's...
When I was talking with Summer in New York in February, I asked her about that moment in 2015.
I used to wake up at night. Me and my sister, we would take shifts of one to sleep. You know, she would do morning, I would do night, and each of us would hold a weapon.
Probably not the best time for a wedding.
Nobody would attend a wedding anyways during that time. I had flowers shipped in from Ethiopia. I'm not even lying. And I had to cancel that. I was really bummed out.
The wedding was off.
I really felt devastated because we've been like waiting for this for too long.
The fighting was very dangerous where Summer was. She needed to go north, where it was a little safer. There were still Saudi airstrikes there, but no street fighting. And Muntazir was there.
Okay, so Summer got to Sana'a and to Muntazir, and they're getting married?
Yeah, but Summer's dad can't be there. He's in New York City, and nobody's able to fly in. The airport's been bombed. Summer's relatives in South Yemen, they can't get there either, for basically the same reason.
I know. She was, like, really devastated about the wedding. But we were, like, going through, like, very tough circumstances.
But they do put on a wedding. Nothing fancy. It's in Muntazir's parents' house in Sana'a, and they kind of throw it together.
Thank you.
So I asked Summer and Muntazir what music they played at their wedding. This one is by a singer from southern Yemen. His name is Fuad Abdul Wahib.
And what's he singing about?
It's a love song, a man admiring a woman's beauty, asking her to bring him a cup and make him drink it. And in some lines, the singer jumps from admiring her to asking her to dance.
I love this, and this is such great music.
So Summer remembers the wedding really well. She remembers this moment when all the men came into the room where she and the women were, and they were bringing Muntazir.
At first, like, he comes in and everybody starts clapping and
dancing. Some music, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, he kissed my forehead, and we went into the Arabian room setting that they have in every traditional home. And the family was there. A woman came up congratulating, and, his brothers and his father and all of them. And then they all stepped out, and then we got to have our time to talk.
But not a lot of time. There are fighter jets flying over Sana'a, and the house they're in, it's right next door to a military target.
We left early because everybody leaves at that time due to the strikes. And all of a sudden, we're leaving the house, and all we hear is the planes. And you see them flashing, right? And I said, oh my God, like, holy crap. So all of a sudden, my mom sees the planes, and she freaks out, right? So she's like, oh my God. And all the siblings, we all got squished in one car because the first airstrike hit. And it was very close. It's so funny. Like, and now I think about it, it should be a movie. That night, I could not sleep because of the airstrikes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really bad.
The doors are like, I remember the doors were like really shaking.
Yeah.
Really shaking because of how strong the earth was shaking because of the rockets hitting.
And, you know, my mom would call every 10 minutes.
Are you okay?
Are you okay? I'm like, no, are you okay? You know?
Sana'a is a city under siege. Airstrikes day in, day out. The campaign is led by Saudi Arabia and backed by the West.
In May 2015, President Obama met with Arab leaders at Camp David. You might remember this.
Mm.
And later, the Obama administration fast-tracked the sale of major weapons to coalition countries. Saudi Arabia alone bought $1.29 billion worth of bombs, $1.15 billion worth of tanks, and $500 million of ammunition. Back in Yemen, Summer and Muntazir were still living under bombs. The war showed no signs of ending, and they were thinking about fleeing to the United States. And right then, we talked with Summer on the show again.
Summer Nasser went to Yemen this spring to visit her family and got stuck in the war.
Right now, it's about 5:30. There's jets over us. As you can hear, the anti-aircraft missiles and gun shootings. From what I know, they're hitting the airport. Listen closely. Basically, we hear them over us. I mean, we really don't know where they strike until we see smoke.
Oh my gosh.
So, they're going to get out of Yemen, but it isn't easy. They do get out, though. They fly out and they get as far as Amman, Jordan, and Muntazir's visa becomes a problem there. U.S. officials won't grant him a visa. He can't come to the United States. 5 months, they're stuck in Amman. Summer flies back to New York City to try to speed up the process. And 9 months after that, Muntazir gets his visa.
When I picked him up at the airport, he was so excited. And I said, you know, welcome to your new home. And this is it, you know. Took him to the car and I drove around. We drove everywhere. We drove over the bridges and he couldn't believe it. He was so excited. I said, you're going to let me, like, focus on driving? Because I can't drive, you know, when you're so excited. And, you know, to be together was like a... It was truly a blessing after all of that. To be honest, now I'm thinking about it, I'm like, wow, this is really what we went through.
Yeah. Summer and Muntazir, they escaped the war, and it's never far from their thoughts.
We have to wake up every morning, and we have to sleep every night.
checking our phones the last 10 minutes before 10 o'clock. We have to check our social networks. We have to check our family.
What are Summer and Muntazir doing now, Stephen?
Well, Muntazir's driving for Uber. Summer is finishing up her undergrad degree. She's still a college student.
Yeah.
She's also a paralegal, and they work together with other young Yemeni professionals. They started up a charity called Yemen Aid. Love that name, Yemen Aid. And when we spoke at the end of February, the group had loaded up a 40-foot shipping container with medical equipment and supplies and sent it to hospitals in Yemen. And there's a second container on the way right now. One last thing I wanted to share, and there's some nice tweeting birds in the background. This is the sound of the street outside Summer and Matazer's apartment. It's quiet, it's February, gray skies, raining a little bit. And after going out for some great New York Yemeni food with them, I drive back to Boston. I'm taking Connecticut Route 15.
I know that drive, Merritt Parkway.
In half a mile, exit to exit 53, State Route 110, Stratford, Shelton.
Now, you probably know this huge building off to the left if you're driving north. It's the headquarters of the Sikorsky Aircraft Corporation.
Always pointed out to my kid.
Can't miss it.
Turn right on Main Street, then turn right.
So they make the Black Hawk helicopter. It's just one of the items that the Saudi-led coalition countries buy from the United States in huge numbers.
Yeah, there is plenty of support for the Saudi position, though, right? I mean, especially to hold the line against Iran and to support America's Arab allies.
Proceed to the route.
And there are strong arguments for the U.S. to stay engaged with Saudi Arabia to help the Saudis and the UAE do a better job of targeting military, not civilian targets. But after 3 years, the Houthis still control Yemen's capital. 10,000 Yemenis have died in the war. Cholera and diphtheria are widespread. 2 million people have been driven from their homes by the fighting. 18 million Yemenis don't have enough food. And the war in Yemen shows no sign of ending.
And in the middle of all that, there's Summer and Muntazir. I had no idea she was even getting married. Stephen Snyder, thanks very much for bringing us their story.
My pleasure.
You can see pictures of Summer and Muntazir in New York and in Yemen. It's all part of our ongoing reporting on Yemen at PRI.org. A quick look ahead to some special coverage we'll have for you next week on the show. We've been telling you about the rising rates of women being sentenced to prison around the world. In many cases, the numbers are up because more women are going into prison for nonviolent offenses, mostly for drugs. Coming up on Monday, we go inside one of Thailand's most crowded prisons. Thailand and the U.S. are the two countries with the highest rates of female incarceration in the world. And in Thailand, 8 out of 10 women in prison are there for drug possession. But Thai authorities are beginning to question the policy of mass incarceration.
We put a lot of people in jail, but it seems that we're losing war on drug. My question is that, should we legalize drugs?
Is Thailand's American-style war on drugs a failure? We'll have that story on Monday when we continue with Unequal Justice, a series from our Across Women's Lives desk. Not that we needed it, but here in New England, we got a taste of the future this past winter. Not once, but twice. Water washed over the streets of downtown Boston. Both times we got a 1, 2, 3 punch of a big storm, super high tides, and rising sea levels. And scientists tell us we need to be prepared for a lot more coastal flooding and erosion as climate change kicks into higher gear. Governments here in the U.S. and elsewhere are struggling to prepare for that future. That means trying to protect the coasts where they can, but sometimes it also means letting go. That's what's happening in parts of the U.K. Yesterday on the show, we heard the story of one family facing that reality in the seaside town of Haysborough. It's a small village on England's eastern coast that's slowly crumbling into the sea. Today, our Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler takes us to another corner of Haysborough. It's the town's pub, right next door to a 15th-century church and roughly a football field inland from the village's soft clay cliffs.
The Hill House Inn is the only pub in town, and it's the kind of place where regulars bring their kids on a Saturday night. They color at tables in the corner while their parents have a pint.
We are sitting in a 16th-century inn, which has been actually a pub since about 1610.
Landlord Clive Stockton likes to boast that it's listed on the Register of Historic Places. One corner is dedicated to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who Stockton says wrote one of his Sherlock Holmes mysteries here.
He wrote The Adventures of the Dancing Men, which is why we call our brewery the Dancing Men Brewery.
The inn is still partly heated with an old stove. Stockton's wife, Sue, is stoking it with coal the morning I visit.
With all the equipment in the world, I'm using my hands.
We've got a big log burner, but we always light it with coal first thing because it's easier to get it going.
We're just an old-fashioned inn right on the coast. Sadly, with a very short life left.
To show me why, Stockton leads me through a dark dining room with dangerously low ceilings toward a back window.
Apart from the salt on the windows, the sea is only just there, of course.
An entire trailer park sits between us and the water, but the soft cliffs are eroding so fast, Stockton estimates the North Sea will be at his back door in 25 to 30 years. And the UK government's decided not to fund expensive new sea defences here and along large stretches of the coast.
A lifetime's work invested in a property that is listed and so, you know, theoretically should be defended, but it doesn't work like that. The problem for my wife and I is this isn't just our business, it's our home. So the day this is demolished because the sea is here, we are left with nothing.
Stockton spent years in local government fighting for new protections for Haysborough, but it didn't happen. He says his land isn't worth much now, so he can't really sell, and it would be way too expensive to try to move the building.
But it's still a successful business, and we've got 25 or 30 years to make some money out of it. So that's what we've accepted. We've expanded, we've put a brewery in, we've got the coffee shop and the carvery, and we're just determined to make the most of it while it's still here.
The inn will probably outlast Stockton, who's 69 years old. So will most of Haysborough's homes, which sit farther inland. But the buildings in the village's historic core are among its most vulnerable.
Once the pub, the church go, then there is a school. There are two small shops and a post office, and that's it. So Haysborough will cease to be the lively and active community that it is.
I'll be back in an hour.
After all, what's an English village without its pub? For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Haysborough, England.
There was a 50th anniversary this week that I can't believe I overlooked because when it happened, I became obsessed for years.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey blew my mind as a 7-year-old, and I wasn't even into sci-fi. I did read Arthur C. Clarke's novel to satisfy my obsession, but it just didn't register the way the movie did. I saw it 8 times before I was a teenager at a movie theater. Today I own it on Blu-ray, and it still holds up, cinematic devices as well as its messages. We may be living through an age of technology overload and artificial intelligence, but in 1968, 2001 was already onto it. There was HAL, that frightening omen of high-tech run amok, and that video phone on the space station, that foreshadowed Skype.
Can't you think of anything else you want for your birthday? Something very special?
Yes.
What?
A bush baby.
A bush baby? Well, we'll have to see about that. Listen, sweetheart, I want you to tell Mommy something for me. Will you remember?
Even if you don't remember when it came out, 2001 also spawned a powerful musical trope that, for better or worse, lives today and will probably be with us at least until 3001. Five notes from German composer Richard Strauss. Five notes that would forever be co-opted as walk-on music by sports teams, wrestlers, showmen. Elvis used it as the opening to his concerts. Any oversized ego that needed kettle drums and high drama for an entrance. In 2001, though, what an entrance. For Kubrick, it was actually a spontaneous choice. In the late 1800s, Strauss was into composing something known as tone poems, a single-movement piece of music based on a literary work. This one was based on a wild philosophical narrative by Friedrich Nietzsche called Also sprach Zarathustra, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. I won't go into what it all means, except that Nietzsche has the hero pronounce famously that God is dead. Strauss's musical work is more than 40 minutes long. Kubrick used only the 90-second opening fanfare, but almost didn't. He had recruited Hollywood composer Alex North to score 2001. They'd worked together on Spartacus a few years earlier. But during post-production on 2001, the Mercurial Kubrick decided that he preferred the placeholder music to the original score he'd commissioned, and he abandoned Alex North's work. Apparently, Stanley Kubrick was onto something. The BBC later used the music in their coverage of the Apollo 11 moon landing, and the Berlin Philharmonic's recording of it hung out on Billboard's classical music chart for 36 weeks in 1969. A version of it even made it into Billboard's pop charts in 1973, thanks to Brazilian funkmeister Lumir Diodato. I guess nothing gets old if you treat it with the right amount of respect and funkiness. And there's a little bass solo so we can get out of the show today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Back to you, Diodato.
PRI, Public Radio International.